Hello and welcome to Boring Beige Box, the weekly podcast about retro computing. I'm your host, Matt Wilson. If you like to hack away at your autoexec.bat or config.sys files just so you can play King's Quest or Ultima, you're at the right place. From 2400 baud modems to IBM PS1s, to Monkey Island 2, to the Sierra Network, we cover it all if it happened in the 80s and 90s. So clean out that garage, pull out that old boring beige box, and let's have some fun. Welcome to show number 7 for Saturday, May 27th, 2006. Today's topic is the Towers of Power, Part 2, the Pentium. Well, glad everyone could join me today. I'm sorry about not getting the podcast out on Friday. I usually get it out on Fridays, but things became pretty hectic, and I was not able to get it out yesterday. But no worries, I'm here, and I am recording. So, bringing to you some old-school goodness. So, today we're going to be talking about part two, continuation of my segment on the Towers of Power, which was a marketing buzzword for machines back in the 80s and 90s that used their, mainly they were 386 and 486 based machines that were usually in the large full tower form factor that they touted, or they called them Towers of Power. So, anyway, they were definitely extremely large. First off, I would like to just remind everyone of our website. It's www.boringbeigebox.com, and I haven't really updated it, but I'm still kind of playing around with the ideas that of what I want to do with the site. The active portion of the site is obviously the forums, and you can go to those directly at forums.boringbeigebox.com. But the rest of the site has not really gotten any attention yet, but I want to develop some different areas. The hardware area, just showing a list of different systems that I've been talking about. Now, if you go to the hardware area, you'll see some old school advertisements that are pretty neat to look at. They're the obvious type of machines, or they're the typical type of machines that I consider the boring beige boxes, that were very popular in the late 80s to early to mid 90s. So check that out. The software section, I want to put together a list of software like games and different applications that were real popular during the time. But like I said, the most active section is the forums. So just go to forums.boringbeigebox.com, register an account, and jump on. We have a few people on there. I'm taking a look at the forums right now. It looks like we have about 10 or 11 users, and I just want to thank all of the forums people that have gotten out there and started to chat about some of this stuff. There was a couple different people that have said some really nice things this past week. If you look under the Boring Beige Box podcast section of the forums, there is a post by Apple II Guy. And he says that he mentioned he noticed one small error in the podcast last week, and he says there was a faster model of a DX4. AMD sold a DX4 120. I did not know that. I said the highest up 486 was the DX4 100, which was Intel, but he's actually saying that AMD sold a DX4 120. I didn't know that. So thanks, Apple II Guy. He also listed a couple of great links that I did not know about that I'm definitely looking into and I'm using for part of this podcast. A couple different sites. CPU Collection. Actually, it's www.cpu-collection.de. It looks like a German site, but it is in English. So that's definitely a good site. Now, the one I like the most is cpu-info.com. It has a really good layout. The menu at the top shows all the different CPUs, Intel, Cyrix, AMD, some other ones, and it's got a really good article on the Pentiums, which I am using for part of the podcast today. It also has a lot of pictures. Every single processor you can think of, it's got a picture of it. Also, the same is for cpu-collector.com. Now, I also like that site a lot that Apple II guy mentioned. They have, it says here, 567 CPUs in the collection. And, I mean, they have everything you can imagine. And they have pictures of them, details about them. I mean, this site is just amazing. I mean, there's so much information on. They have very large, very clear pictures, JPEG pictures of the different chips. I'm looking at one right now, exactly the one that Apple II guy talked about, the AMD DX4-120 running at 120 megahertz. It actually has the logo on there designed for Microsoft Windows 95. I still kind of, you know, they always use that marketing scheme to stamp the design for Windows or design for Microsoft on different products, software and hardware. I actually didn't know they did this stuff for hardware. Anyway, So those are some great sites that talk about processors. Also, I got an email from a guy that goes by the name of Winston, and I'll read his email. He seems like a really great guy. He goes, "Hi, just wanted to drop you a line to let you know that I'm enjoying your show and looking forward to each new episode. I heard about you through RetroBits and am happy I stopped by to check out the show." He says, "I'm not primarily a PC guy. I started out on the TRS-80, then moved to the Atari 8-bits, the Apple II, and finally to the Macintosh. However, I'm not one of those religious zealot Mac types who can't bear the thought of using any other kind of computer, and I'm always happy to learn whatever I can about PCs. Besides, I worked on a lot of SPSS programming and batch file creation on DOS-based IBM PC XTs when I was in college. Those were hot machines then. And I support some Windows machines in my current job. The era of PC history about which I know the least is the very one that your podcast covers, so it's of particular interest to me. I've been meaning to write for a while. I think I came in around episode 3. But, now this is very interesting. This Winston, if you're listening, you're a great guy, because his real name is John, but he says to go by Winston because that's how everyone knew him in the old BBS days. So Winston says, this guy is amazing. He reads, okay, let me read this to you. Winston, you're a great guy. He goes, "I think I came in around episode 3, but while reading an old issue of PC Magazine at lunch yesterday," yes, I'm that much of a nerd, "I ran across," we're all nerds, geeks, I like to say geeks, "I ran across the phrase, boring beige box," in quotes, in one of the articles. It's from the November 11th, 1986 issue, so it's nearly 20 years old. So now, I thought that boring beige box was coined around the time of when the Apples, when Steve Jobs came back on board and starting doing the different, you know, different colored iMacs or different colored Macs that came out, and that they were trying to get away from that boring beige box in the mid to later 90s. But it looks like that the term was used as early as 1986. So, and he says, "Do you know of any use of the expression that came before that?" And I don't. I mean, that's the earliest. I thought it was later that term started to be used. I certainly was surprised to see it. And now he's scanning the article for me from the magazine and posted a link to it. And I'm looking here at the article, and it looks like that it is from, says from the editor's screen, Bill Macaroni, I don't know how to say his name, but it's the article name is Form Follows Function. And there is an article, and this is in 1986. He says the Clone Wars are over. You know, they're just beginning at this time, Bill. Users have transcended their need for their compatibles to be slavish copies of IBM. IBM is working hard on custom gate arrays to do integration of virtually every part of the PC in a frantic effort to bring down manufacturing costs and make cloning more difficult. And as you know, cloning just got easier and easier. And he says, it's too late. As I've said before, DOS is the standard, not IBM. Bill Gates has won. Now, this was in 1986. He's created a software bus that is capable of linking dissimilar machines. Today, the machines are not especially dissimilar. But over the next year or two, you'll see significant divergence in hardware, with DOS anchoring these new machines firmly to the mainstream. Now, here's the the third paragraph has the boring beige box in it. Time was that anything that varied too far from the IBM look, even down to the color, didn't have a chance in the marketplace. Now designers are taking liberties with the form factor. They're coaxing the boring beige box into new and interesting shapes, shapes that will take the PC into new places and applications. And this that was in 1986, but I'm sorry, the boring beige box design continued way into the 90s, and I would say they really didn't start turning over until the early 2000s when Dell started making the black computers. They were always the IBM. Now, that's what's funny. IBM switched over early on to make black colored machines, but really Dell in the mainstream was the one that helped convert, I think, all of them to be either black or silver colored. But I remember using Dell Optiplex computers when I worked for a company by the name of Sapient as a web developer in Chicago, when we used the beige colored boxes, and that was back in like 2001. 2001, that time period. So, I mean, it's the boring beige box continued on well into the 2000s. So, anyway, thanks a lot, Winston, for sending that article in. That is very, very neat. And he says, you know, just some nice things. I'm sure I'll write again to let you know more specifically what I think of the show, but suffice it to say that I appreciate the time you take to make it for us and wish you the same success that Earl Evans is having with RetroBits. If it's fun for you to make, then you know it'll be fun for us to listen to. Best regards, Winston. Thanks, Winston. I really appreciate that. That really means a lot. It's very, very nice of you to say those kind words. I do. I love doing this. It's a lot of fun to make. I like thinking about some of these the old days and reminiscing over the different machines that I used when I was young, and it's definitely a lot of fun to make the show. So I hope that everyone continues to enjoy it. All right, let's get started on the main topic. I hopefully will not be as long today. Some of the past shows have gone quite long, but I will try not to go too far over 30 minutes or so. Today's topic, like I said, is a continuation, The Towers of Power, Part 2. This podcast, I want to cover the Pentium. The Pentium was, I think, really the turning point for modern processors. You know, for so long they had the 8086, 8088, the 286, 8646, and we were so caught up, I think, with those different the naming, the number structure of the processors. The Pentium name came about because of the ongoing battle with AMD that Intel had over the naming structure. Intel was trying to trademark the name 8386 or 8486, but the courts ruled that you can't trademark a number. So they decided to come up with a brand new marketing campaign, and they came up with the name Pentium. So basically, the Pentium was just a step up from the 486. It had a couple different changes to the processor. Variably, obviously, the speed was faster. There was a couple of different. Now, for me, when the Pentium came out, it was very expensive, and the Pentium chip was released in March of 1993. Now, the first system I got was in 1992, and it was a 386 SX 25 megahertz. That was in August of 92. So you think the next year, I mean, it's the Pentium chip. And I didn't even have a chance to have the 486. So I never had the latest and greatest. And a lot of us have probably gone through that. But what happened with me was I went through a series of 486s. And I believe I didn't get my first Pentium-based system until later in the 90s. The reason is because, for one, the price was so high, but also, and I want to get into this later, there were some cheaper alternatives. AMD has always been a cheaper alternative, but there was one that was even cheaper, was the Cyrix chip. And if you guys remember these, I mean, a lot of you will probably have some fond memories of the Cyrix. It could be a crappy processor at times, but it was darn cheap. I had a Cyrix 6x86. I forget the speed, but it was either like around 100 or 150 megahertz, something like that. And boy, those things were cheap. So I'll get into those later, but that's when I first built my own machine. Was I built two computers, one for me and one for my family, when I was in college, around, I would say, 1997. Christmas of 97. And I used the Cyrix chips, and those were really cheap. So anyway, but I'll get into those chips in a little bit. So the Pentium came out, and there was a couple different models. They were codenamed some different things. There was the P5, which those ran at 60 megahertz. The very first Pentium ran at 60 megahertz. Now, if you remember, the 486, like we know, could go up to as high as 120. So, you know, there wasn't much difference between the 486s and the Pentium. I think one of the main reasons was they wanted to change the naming structure. There were some major changes from the 486. It had superscalar architecture, and I'm reading this from Wikipedia. It says the Pentium has two data paths or pipelines that allow it to complete more than one instruction per clock cycle. Now, this is different from the 486. One pipe, called U, can handle any instruction, while the other, called V, can handle the simplest, most common instructions. The use of more than one pipeline is a characteristic typical of RISC processor design, the first of many to be implemented on the x86 platform, thus signaling the road to take and showing that it was possible to merge both technologies, creating almost hybrid processors. During this time, you probably remembered a lot about hearing about RISC processors. Now, RISC stands for the Reduced Instruction Set Computer. It's a microprocessor CPU design philosophy that favors a smaller and simpler set of instructions that all take about the same amount of time to execute. The most common RISC microprocessors are ARM, DEC Alpha, if you remember the Alpha chips, PA-RISC, SPARC, remember used for the Sun SPARC, the Sun system, MIPS, and IBM's PowerPC. Now, it says the idea was inspired by the discovery that many of the features that were included on traditional CPU designs to facilitate coding were being ignored by the programs that were running on them. It says also these more complex features took several processor cycles to be performed. Additionally, the performance gap between the processor and main memory was increasing. This led to a number of techniques to streamline processing within the CPU, while at the same time attempting to reduce the total number of memory accesses. So the whole idea of the RISC processor, it became extremely popular in the 90s. So they decided to switch gears and implement some of the RISC processor design in the Pentium. Now, I hope you got all that. That was a lot of information, but it was definitely a time of change with Intel. So the Pentium, the Pentium that I remember a lot was the early stages of the Pentium with the 60. Now, I read a lot about these, but I'd never owned them. The P5 was the 60 megahertz, 66 megahertz. That came out in 1993. Then the P54, those ran at, that was in October of 94, which was 75 megahertz, then 90 megahertz, then 100 megahertz, then 120 megahertz. That was up until March 1995. And then the P54C ran at 133 megahertz, 150, 166, and then 200 megahertz. This was about the time that, if you remember, the Pentium with the MMX technology came out. That actually happened when the P55C models came out. Those ran at 120 megahertz up to 233 megahertz. Now this was around 96, and I remember that was a really big deal when with the MMX technology, and it was supposed to enhance multimedia. And it basically says a little bit about that on the Wikipedia page. It says it had a new set of 57 MMX instructions to improve working on multimedia tasks, such as encoding and decoding media. Mathematically, most of the MMX instructions provided improved support for vectors, matrices, and arrays, complex calculations at the core of multimedia, as well as much scientific work. However, software must be specially optimized to make use of MMX, and the increased speed the P55C showed at its launch was mainly due to the fact that the internal cache had been doubled in size to 32K. MMX is a reference to multimedia extension. Now, I really didn't see much difference or use for MMX. I know there were some games that utilized it, but it was just one of those marketing ploys. I mean, they're always coming up with something new. And then the P55C continued all the way up to 300 megahertz into January 99. So that's pretty much, and then from there, obviously, Pentium 2, Pentium 3, Pentium 4, you know, the Pentium M for mobile editions, Pentium D now, and then the Pentium Extreme Edition. But the original Pentium, I think, really changed a lot of things. Around this time, also, that's when a lot of first-person shooters became really popular. I was totally into to Quake. Quake was huge. I mean, that was like the game to play. I remember I grew up in Myrtle Beach. If any of you guys are familiar with Myrtle Beach, they're actually in North Myrtle Beach. There is an outdoor shopping area called Barefoot Landing in North Myrtle Beach there. And I worked at a place called the General Store. And they sold, it was kind of like a Cracker Barrel, you know, store, but no restaurant. It was just like a general store. They had candy and collectibles and stuff. And you could get, you know, soda or pop or whatever in the original, like, bottles. And they had hot dogs and stuff. And it was a lot of fun. Ice cream and fudge and stuff. And so I remember I worked, this is so long ago. I worked at where they had roasted almonds and you made the almonds. But I remember getting, there were newspapers out on the front porch. They had rocking chairs and stuff. And I would get the newspaper. And in the USA Today, they had articles on Quake. And when it came out and it showed, like, statistics of how many people are going to be buying Quake. And, you know, I mean, it was such a big deal. And that came out in the summer, July 22nd, 1996. And, I mean, that was the biggest deal to have Quake, because it was, like, truly 3D and all the polygons. And, I mean, so it was a big deal. This was the same time, like I said, the Pentium became really, really popular. So all that was, like, a change in computing, especially in the gaming world. So that was it was definitely a time... a time of fun. So the Pentium, I never owned the Pentium until much, much later, I think it was. There were a couple machines, and still, even when I went through and I had a Packard Bell, which was like a 486, I had a Compaq, that Presario that was a 486, had an AST Advantage, which was a 486. Most of them were all high-end, like the 486 DX4, so they were pretty fast. They were pretty comparable to the Pentium. But once I went into college, I really didn't have... I had one system that my dad had loaned me, but I did not have my own computer. I had it for one for a while, and I think I bought one, and it may have been... it may have been a Pentium, but I really can't remember building any systems with Pentium chips, the original Pentiums. It was college, man. I mean, everyone's broke in college pretty much. So, but then, like I said, I went to work at a tech support center, a bunch of other college guys. It was a great place to work. I loved it. This was in Columbia, South Carolina. I went to University of South Carolina. And around 1997, like I said, the Christmas of 97, I built two computers, and they were based on the Cyrix chip. Now, if you remember Cyrix, there's some great information on Cyrix on Wikipedia. Cyrix was kind of like the redheaded stepchild of processors. And they did a couple, 486 processors, but they were pretty low end. But when they came out with the 6x86, that was really the most popular processor. And it was a Pentium clone. It says later in 1995, Cyrix released its best known chip, the 6x86, which was the first Cyrix CPU to exceed the performance of the Intel chip it was intended to compete against. Initially, so it actually performed better than the Pentium. Initially, but in some areas, not in all areas, specifically for gaming, this was its downfall. Initially, Cyrix tried to charge a premium for its extra performance, but the 6x86's math coprocessor was not as fast as that in the Intel Pentium. Due to the increasing popularity of first-person 3D games, Cyrix was forced to lower its price. You got to have that fast math coprocessor for first-person 3D games. While the 6x86 quickly gained a following among computer enthusiasts and independent computer shops, unlike AMD, its chips had yet to be used by a major OEM customer. So, for people that built their own systems, it was a great low-cost chip, but they never went over well with OEMs. They were never put into computers that would sell in the big box retail, stores. You really can never find a system, say in a Circuit City or wherever, CompUSA, that were built on the 6x86. And then the last, I remember some of these. They were machines that had. This is at the time when in 96, 97, there were machines that started to have motherboards with everything built onto the motherboard, like the graphics card, the sound, the Ethernet, everything, the NIC, everything was built into the board. And this was when it really, low-cost computers started to take off, low-end, low-cost computers. And they had something called the Media GX CPU. And this is a pretty crappy, CPU. This is also by Cyrix. They released it in 1996, and it integrated all of the major discrete components of a PC. So it usually when you bought a Media GX based motherboard, it came with all those components, sound and video, onto the one motherboard. It was initially based on the old 5x86 technology and running at 120-133 megahertz. Its performance was widely criticized, but its low price made it successful. The Media GX led to Cyrix's first big win when Compaq used it in its lowest price Presario 2100 and 2200 computer. This led to further Media GX sales to Packard Bell and also seemed to give Cyrix legitimacy, as 6x86 sales to Packard Bell on e-machines quickly followed. It says later versions of the Media GX ran at speeds of up to 333 megahertz and added MMX support. Now, after that, they had some legal troubles and basically merged with National Semiconductor, and you pretty much don't even hear of them anymore. So the legacy of Cyrix says, although the company was short-lived and the brand name was no longer actively used by its current owner, Cyrix's competition with AMD created the market for budget CPUs, which cut the average selling price of PCs and ultimately forced Intel to release its Celeron line of budget processors and cut the prices of its faster processors more quickly in order to compete. So if it wasn't for Cyrix and their Pentium clone when they first started, we wouldn't have the Celeron, and Intel would not cut their prices so quickly. Intel chips are awesome. I mean, they're really, really good. But the prices are too high. A lot of people go with AMD that build their own machines. I currently have a system with an AMD chip, and I love it. It's great. But the cost is a lot less than the Intel Pentium chip. But now AMD and Intel are pretty comparable. AMD in the early days was not as comparable to Intel. But now I think AMD is as good, or if not better, than Intel. So, you know, Intel continues to change and grow, and I think they're doing a lot of great things, and they are, you know, very, very good, but I like AMD just mainly because of the price point. So anyway, it also says additionally the acquisition of Cyrix's intellectual property and agreements would be used by VIA, V-I-A, if you know those guys, the chipset makers, to defend itself from its own legal troubles with Intel, even after VIA Technologies stopped using the Cyrix name. So that's pretty much the history of the Pentium. And now today we continue, even after, from 1993, that's almost over 10, I'm so bad with math. If it's 2006, so 13 years. For 13 years, the Pentium name has continued on. And I think it's going to go on for a long time. They have a solid brand with Pentium. You know, that's the Pentium chip. It changed a lot of things in computing. Well, that's about it for today's show. I'd like to thank everybody for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show. If you like the show, send me an email. Tell your friends to check me out. Our website is www.boringbeigebox.com. You can also subscribe if you use RSS news readers. There's a great one I use called Feed Reader. Any of the new Web 2.0 type websites such as Yahoo, MSN. There's a bunch out there that you can subscribe to RSS feeds, and you can see when my show is released, or either when I do show notes, which may not always be the same day. But if you go to, I do my hosting with a company called Libsyn, L-I-B-S-Y-N. If you go to boringbeigebox.libsyn.com, that's L-I-B-S-Y-N.com, you can see a list of all my shows, and you can just download them from there automatically if you want to, or, you know, on demand, you can download the shows. You can see the show notes, but there's also a link on the left-hand side. There's one called the Feed Burner, where you can actually subscribe with your feed reader to that. Now, if you're using iTunes, you probably found the show in iTunes, or either you can actually subscribe in iTunes using my RSS feed, which is boringbeigebox.libsyn.com/RSS. Or like I said, you could go to the Libsyn website and use the feed burner, which is at the bottom. All you have to do is right-click on it and or click on it and look at the address in the address bar. It's feeds.feedburner.com/boringbeigebox. And you can use Yahoo or any different kind of feed reader to subscribe to that, so you can see when I update the show. So definitely check that out. There's plenty of options to get the show. You know, like I said, if you like the show, send me an email. If you have any ideas for topics, send me an email. My address is podcast@boringbeigebox.com. I'd definitely like to hear from you. All right, well, thanks so much for listening, and have a great week. See you next week.